Welcome back once again to BadQuaker.com. It's Wednesday, May 25th, 2011. I'm Ben.
And I'm Kai.
And we're back with you again from BadQuaker.com. We're going to talk about a couple things. One is from a listener email that we're going to touch on that. Another thing, though, that we wanted to start with was last week we had talked about the ethics or the morality of voting or whether we should or shouldn't vote. Kai and I expressed our opinions on that. And we didn't much more than publish the podcast until Tom Woods put out an article that totally shot us down. And I don't think, Tom probably is not aware that we exist. That's not the point. But
actually, he does. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, it'd be nice if Tom listened. And actually, I hate to put down anything that Tom Woods would say because he's really one of my favorite current authors. And he's a great guy. I would have nothing negative to say about Tom, and I definitely recommend his books. I've got several of his books around here. I love reading what he writes, and I love his lectures too Ludwig von Mises Institute and Mises.com, or I'm sorry, Mises.org. Anyway, but in the article that Tom put out, he just made two points. And both of them were really weak. Now, he's put out two articles since then. One, he quoted Roderick Long, and I, like I was telling Kai before we started, the last thing I would ever want to do in life is be on the opposite side of an argument with Roderick Long, because the guy has just a phenomenal mind. But I'm pretty sure that we're not changing our position on this. Are you changing?
That seems to be, despite that we don't want to be on the opposite side, here we are on the opposite side.
Yeah.
And I think it kind of, for me, it comes down to an issue of whether you believe in the good of society or whether you believe in the good of the individual.
Yeah, we were talking earlier about duty. They tell us a lot. It's your duty to vote. It's your responsibility to vote, mm-hmm. And that really. I'm not a Randian. I don't bow at the idol of Rand or go offer sacrifices at the Rand altar or any of that. But frankly, I can't sit and read her books. It's just I have wallpaper to go. Watch Peel.
I've read War and Peace, and I can't read her books, so that should tell you something there.
But any, and Rand supported voting. She supported the campaign of Goldwater back in 1964. Mm-hmm. But yet, our point that we talked about earlier is that you don't have a responsibility to society. You only have a responsibility to yourself. Mm-hmm. And if you're doing something, if you're taking action that is for yourself, that is somehow making your life better, making yourself better, it's improving your situation, then that's a good move that will help society. If, on the other hand, you're making a move just for society, then you're not necessarily helping yourself and you're not necessarily helping society.
Yeah, and I think that boils down to the core principles of socialism versus capitalism. In capitalism, there's this idea that you take care of yourself and you do things that benefit you and you do things that make your situation better. And as a result, society gets stronger and everyone benefits. And by sort of being selfish, you help everyone. And then a socialist has a tendency to say that you have to be forced to help others, and you have to really go out of your way to do that, giving up sacrifices, for yourself, and that you shouldn't be selfish and you should do things for others. And I don't think that improves anyone's situation.
Yeah, when we were talking earlier about this, before we started recording, I had mentioned the Peace Corps as opposed to a person in private business. A person who goes out and decides they want to be productive in some way. for their own selfish needs. They, you know, grow. I love to use apple trees as, you know, so you have somebody who plants apple trees, and then they harvest the apples, and then they sell the apples. Of course, this is purely out of greed because they want money mm-hmm. for their apples. So they grow apples and they sell apples. Well, they do get the money because of their effort and their
and so their situation is improved.
Their situation is improved, but also there are now apples for people to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody else who, you know, milks a cow doesn't have any apples. And so now they can milk their cow and they can sell their milk and they can afford apples.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have a better balance. And this is how the division of labor works. So we all profit by our own, you can use the negative term, selfish and greed, and you know, but that's really what it is. We all together are better off because of our own individual desire to help ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so when, as long as we're desiring to help ourselves, we help everybody. But then you go and you join the Peace Corps, or you go and join one of the United Nations efforts to help third world countries or whatever, and you're off digging a well somewhere, and you're actually eating tax money. You think you're doing good, but in the long run, you're not being productive for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You're eating someone else's tax money.
Yep.
So in the long run, no matter that it looks like you're doing good, you're actually producing more harm than good.
Mm-hmm.
Relating that back to, we kind of wandered there, relating that back to voting, someone can argue, though, that you're actually doing good for yourself when you vote if you're improving the government. What do you think about that?
Well, firstly, I think the notion that you can improve the state is a fallacy perpetrated by the state. And I'd like to bring up the point that the re-electing of George W. Bush, more people voted. There was a higher percentage of voters than we had had in quite some time. And it did not improve
the situation. It actually kind of encouraged Bush in his further pressing
mm-hmm.
of the ridiculous policies that he was pushing.
And we had the same thing happen when Obama got elected. There was a massive surge, particularly among young people, and it resulted in no change to bad change.
Yeah.
It either did not help the situation any, or it actually made it worse.
Yeah, it sort of gave Obama the idea that it justified his behavior,
mm-hmm.
and things got even worse. But so let's theorize, though. Let's say in a magic world where you know, everybody always uses the example of unicorns and chicklets, or unicorns and butterflies, or unicorns and rainbows. But let's just imagine that Ron Paul could somehow magically win the Republican nomination.
Right.
And then, you know, Ron Paul is somehow magically moving towards taking the presidency. Then, one could argue, voting would be good for the individual, because it would be good for the individual if Ron Paul were elected president. And then he could shut down these bad government policies and bad government. Or the other argument in this realm, okay, so reality is Ron Paul's not going to get elected, but if we can make a statement and get more people understanding libertarianism, more people moving towards this idea, wouldn't that be a good thing for the individual?
Right, and that's, I think, a logical fallacy that is very easy to believe in, and it gives a lot of hope to people, and it's sort of, rah, yeah, go our team. But I think the fact of the matter is, one, if Ron Paul were to get elected, he would not be able to change the system. And two, if he's not elected, and we do have a massive upsurge in, you know, oh, look, we have a chance, you know, you should vote for a third party. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, the state lives.
When you look at throughout American history, there have been third parties, there have been multiple parties,
mm-hmm.
there have been No party systems. There have been all of these things, and it doesn't matter. The government will continue to get more and more impressive because that's what governments do.
Yeah, and I think that's really the heart of it, and the really core is to ask yourself this question. Let's assume that we could tweak the government somehow and help it and make it better, and there would be less oppression or less taxes or balanced budget or eliminate the Fed or whatever the pet project is that really causes a person to get upset about the government. Assuming we could tweak the government and make that one or two or five aspects better about the government, have we helped the situation? And the answer is no. Yeah, you're shaking your head.
I don't think we have. Because here's what would happen. As an anarchist, I don't want to help the state. I just don't. I don't want to help the state. And when you make the state smaller, when you make the state more manageable, when you make the state look better, what you're doing is you're creating people who think that the state is good.
Yeah.
They say, see, it can be controlled. It's good. We need it in this area.
And that's the myth of the state. That's why the state always holds on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why one generation after the next, they keep thinking, well, we can fix it. We can fix it. And it just keeps getting more monstrous and more hideous and more evil.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I wanted to, I don't know if I can make this leap, but I wanted to compare the legitimacy of voting to the legitimacy of revolution. In a sense, a vote is like a mini revolution. You're voting, you're saying, I either approve of the present government or I reject the present government and I want to change it. Now, that's basically what a vote is.
Mm-hmm.
It's your voice as to a peaceful mini-revolution or to maintain what we have. So if the vote, being a tiny revolution, is legitimate, then one has to ask oneself, is revolution legitimate?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm a big fan. I've already picked on Tom Woods, Roderick Long, so I might as well throw Murray Rothbard under the bus while I'm here. I'm a huge Murray Rothbard fan. I love reading Murray Rothbard. I was wandering in the libertarian darkness in the wilderness by myself when I found Murray Rothbard. And I went, look, someone else thinks these things. I had no idea that somebody else had already codified this whole thing and put it all together. And reading Rothbard for the first time was just magical for me. So, so you see the appreciation I have for Rothbard. Rothbard said that there were two American wars that were justified. And that was the American War of Independence and the South's attempt.
Not a revolution.
Not a revolution. It was a war of independence. And the South's attempt at independence. And he did say that the South executed the war immorally. He said that, and he what was his four-volume set? Conceived in Liberty. In Rothbard's four-volume set, Conceived in Liberty, he goes through great detail to show how Washington and the supporters of Washington were fighting one war, and a whole nother group of military leaders, guys like Ethan Allen and several others, I'd have to look up their names again to remember exactly what he was saying about them, but they were fighting a different kind of war.
Mm-hmm.
They were fighting a volunteer war without uniforms. They fought when they fought, and they went home when they went home. They hit the enemy, moved away from the enemy. And then you have guys like Washington, and you have Benedict Arnold, and you have Alexander Hamilton, and you have that group. And they wanted a professional European military.
With uniforms.
With uniforms and marching in straight lines and all standing still shooting at each other like a bunch of idiots. Now, it was stupid. And they hire Baron von Steuben, the almost worshipped Baron von Steuben, who was not an actual baron. He was a fake.
Mm-hmm.
So
he was a baron the way Lady Gaga is a lady.
I was waiting for you to say that. You cracked me up when you said that earlier. Steuben brings to Washington the exact thing that we were trying to get away from. And they create the state here where many of us, well, I wasn't alive, but many people in the colonies at the time, whether they realized it in a philosophical point or not, they had been living in an anarchical situation for years. Mm-hmm. And now in comes the state, so they're rebelling to this state, and then Washington and his group stand up and say, we've got a deal. Here's a different kind of a state. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing.
Yep.
And so Rothbard said that there were two legitimate wars in the United States history, one being the War of Independence and the other being the South's attempted independence. My point in that, and how I would disagree with Rothbard to a certain extent, is that both of those were attempts, and there were some, like Ethan Allen I mentioned and others, that were trying to fight it as a non-state fight. Mm-hmm. But essentially, all you're doing is swapping the state for the state.
Yep.
And that's what every single revolution in history has always been. It's just been swapping one state for another state.
Yep.
And if you're going to swap a state for a state, why bother?
Yep.
Why have the slaughter? Why have the... And here's the other thing. When you swap a state for a state, the state you get is always worse than the state you had.
Yep.
So that the English Empire could never have developed what the American Empire has developed. Yep.
And that's a really interesting point, because when you see revolutions happening, what is almost always the case is that industry and capitalism is making it very difficult for the state that is in control to remain in control. And capitalism is making that state obsolete.
Yeah.
And so what ends up happening is a small group of people overtake that state, set up a new state that can then control that level of capitalism.
Go back to trying to manage the, mm-hmm. the market rather than letting it be free.
Especially with the American War for Independence, Britain was really having a hard time holding on to the colonies, and the colonies were evolving to a capitalistic point where...
They didn't need the state.
They didn't need the state. And if there had been no revolution there, mm-hmm. the state would have eventually been drawn away from it because it was not fiscally capable of holding on to that
right.
area.
Right.
And those people would have all of a sudden found themselves with no state at all.
Yeah. The contrast in that time frame, to me, that stands out the greatest is the difference between Sam Adams and John Adams.
Mm-hmm.
John Adams just wanted to swap one state for another, whereas Sam Adams wanted to be free. But, you know, I'm not embracing everything that Sam Adams stood for, because if he lived today, he would be called a terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Sons of Liberty were in every way a terrorist organization. They, and I'm not saying, oh, people are going to get upset. Oh, you're talking about the founders. No. Face reality. They burned people's businesses.
Mm-hmm.
They ran people out of town. They beat people. Now, their ultimate goal was independence. So you say, well, was their ends justified by their means? Well, that's the key. Let's take this back to voting.
Mm-hmm.
That's the key. You're using aggression to accomplish what you want done.
Yep.
And when you vote, you're putting yourself as a part of the state, and the state is aggression.
Yep.
So
what you're saying with when you're voting is that you, let's say they have made a law and it's going to come up on ballot that they're making bottled water illegal. And you think, yeah, that's right. Bottled water ought to be illegal. There's plastic and it's destroying the universe. And what you're saying when you agree to vote for that is, I authorize the state to steal, murder, and imprison people to keep bottled water off the shelves.
Or on the shelf.
Or on the shelf.
Either way. Because the state can only address a problem through the three tools that the state has.
Mm-hmm.
Through aggression, through lies, or through theft.
Mm-hmm.
It only can do those three things. So
yep.
If the state can only do those three things, and I challenge anybody to show me something the state does that's not based on those three things.
Mm-hmm.
It has to steal, it has to lie, and it has to aggress. And if the state is based on those three things, then trying to modify the state so that it produces a result you like is no different than any other statist.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm stuck.
The act of voting in and of itself is a violation of the non-aggression principle.
Yeah. That's a blanket statement that somebody might, you know, say, well, no, it's not true. You know, yes, I am. No, I'm not. Yes, I am. No, I'm not. But if you really think it out, that's what it is. You are putting your little 2 cents of your act in with the rest of those who are supporting the state.
Yep.
To morally justify the state's actions. So,
and as an anarchist, I can't do that.
Much
as I like Ron Paul. Much as I, you know, agree with the Liberty Movement,
I like Tom Woods.
It comes back to that rah-rah, go us team mentality. I would love to pin on the Ron Paul pin and put a sticker on my car and be part of that movement, but it is immoral.
Yeah.
So I can't.
That was something else I mentioned earlier about school spirit.
Yeah.
we were going to talk about... a listener email that had asked about child raising and family growing up with libertarian and anarchical views. And I should mention that for me to get where I am today as the complete anarchist based on libertarian philosophy, anarcho-capitalist, I wasn't always like that. You know, the position I'm in is a constantly evolving position. I am entirely open to learn new things and adjust what I believe. I started out, 1979, I was going door to door for normal, passing out brochures and getting signatures to try to change the marijuana laws. I look back on that now and I think, what a waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what a waste of effort to ask, boy, I didn't mean to take it in this direction at all. But since I'm sitting on this, I might as well say it. To ask the state's permission to grow a plant?
Mm-hmm.
Come on. I mean, oh, wait, let's change the law so it's legal. No, let's ignore the state.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not I don't use marijuana in any way. I don't grow marijuana. I don't buy. I don't sell marijuana. I don't have anything to do with marijuana. It's not the point. The state is going to tell you a plant is forbidden or a plant is not forbidden. Now, I've always had the thought that this could be solved really easy if every doper, every pothead, every marijuana smoker out there just saved their seeds and planted them everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Start growing seedlings and put them everywhere. Have pot growing out of every, you know, dandelions. Imagine the government trying to outlaw dandelions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you made pot plants grow like dandelions, how could they, mm-hmm. how could they, the state could not enforce this law.
Yep.
And that's how you beat the state. You don't go and try to change the state. You don't try to take up arms and revolt against the state. None of these things will work. You ignore it. You pretend it's not there, and you go about your life. And that's how you dissolve the state. And you educate yourself, and you educate everybody you can as to what the state is and what it really, how hideous it is.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, you are... sort of a logical anarchist. You've come to the position of anarchy through logic and through reading about things and through making, you know,
I kind of wandered off there, didn't I?
But I was never that type of anarchist. I was an emotional anarchist, always. For me, it was never a matter of having to learn about anarchy and go, oh, that makes sense. It was... of course that's what you're going to do. What else would you do, you know? And I think being raised the way I was raised has a lot to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was never expected to conform to the things that are sort of expected of most people to conform to.
Yeah, we did kind of provide an odd life for you guys, didn't we?
That might be an understatement.
We probably shouldn't start that on a short half-hour podcast. That's maybe an epic journey that we can... 16-hour podcast as we discover the strange life. It was a long, strange trip.
Yeah. But it for me, to kind of briefly address the email, as far as raising children, I think the best thing that you can do is expose them to everything you can expose them to. Take them places...
Like leprosy?
Yeah. Teach them, you know, that you have to really learn everything you can learn.
And just for background information, my wife, Cindy, and I raised three wonderful kids. They're all three adults now. Kai is my daughter that's here with me. We raised three wonderful kids. They're all three adults. They're all three, successful. They're doing great. We're very proud of all three of them. When my son was the first of the three, when he was first born, I was like every other parent. You know, I was like 22 years old, something like that, 23 maybe. Scared to death, and yet thinking I knew everything at the same time, and knowing nothing. I think back now as to how much I really knew, and I'm just surprised at how stupid I was. but I didn't realize I was that stupid. I thought I was doing great, you know. But, I was trying my best, and I was very disciplinarian with Brian. By the time Kai was born, that was a year and a half, 2 years later, something like that. Mm-hmm. It was about a year and a half between the guys. I had mellowed a little bit by the time that Kai was born.
Really? That was mellowed?
But there was a positive and a negative there. First off, compared to my parents, my method of child raising was vastly different because my parents were... my mom was very emotional, so she believed in physical discipline, but she hated the physical discipline, so she would wait until she was angry, and then she would over-discipline. My dad, I think in my whole life, I think I only remember physical discipline from my dad twice. But it was pretty scary, he didn't actually harm me or hurt me or anything, but just the thought of it, he was so big and powerful and, you know, so his deep booming voice and everything, that for him to actually whack me on the butt, and each time it was one smack on the butt, that was it. Mm-hmm. That was the whole event, both times. But it was extremely traumatic because he just didn't do that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't want to be in either of those two cases with my kids. But I was very strict early on, and as the years progressed, I started to realize that I really wasn't getting the correct results that I wanted. I had, with the first two, I had kids that were very well behaved. We could go anywhere. We could go to any restaurant. We could sit on a plane. We could sit on a train. I remember we took a train trip. It was unbelievable. We took a train trip from L.A. to Chicago and then down to Cincinnati and then back to Chicago and then all the way across the country back to L.A. again. How much of that do you remember?
Small amounts. I was very young at the time.
That was wild. Myself, my wife, and two little kids, and we're riding the train. It was just fantastic. But you could see people's faces when they would see us with these two little kids, and it was like, oh, no. And then hours would go by, and they wouldn't make any noise. They would play quietly. They would call her. They would do whatever they were doing very politely, very respectfully, and people would just be blown away by it. And I think part of it was the high level of discipline, but I think part of it was not discipline. It was attention. Not attention like, I'll give you everything you ask for, but attention like you pay attention to everything that the child is doing. And when the child begins to do something wrong, you correct them then.
Mm-hmm.
You don't wait to the point of where you're emotional about it. You know, if you wait until you're emotional about the issue, it's already too late.
Right.
The child is, it's like a dog, okay? Oh, don't compare the child to a dog. Child is exactly like a dog. Actually, a dog is exactly like a child. We bred them to be like children. Anyway, if you have a dog and he pees on your carpet, don't beat him. Indicate to him what you want him to do. Because mm-hmm. he doesn't know, okay? If he pees on the carpet and 2 hours later you find it, and you beat him, you've accomplished nothing other than scaring the dog. Mm-hmm. You teach the dog when the event happens. You provide him an avenue to get out, you know, by taking him on walks and so forth. And once you instruct him, he understands. But if you see him start to pee, don't wait until he's halfway into it and start beating him. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with a child. If you check their emotions, you watch the expressions on their faces, you see how they're acting, you see what they're thinking, and you can literally, just like, you know, like anybody, any human that you work with or you know, you can read the expressions on their face and you can see them when they're about to do something, and you stop them at that point before it ever gets to the point where you're so frustrated you want to beat them. Mm-hmm. Well, I say beat them, that's, you know, of course we're not talking about actual child abuse, but when you're whacking a kid, there's probably, if you had just paid attention, there's steps prior to that that you could have caught mm-hmm. and stopped the behavior before you got frustrated to the point of where you had to whack them. Mm-hmm. So I learned that slowly, so that by the time our third child came along, I had learned that you just don't have to have that level of discipline. If you just pay attention to them and never let them do the little thing, then they never try the big thing. Wherever you draw the line, that's where the kid will, they'll step one step over. So if you draw the line at don't write on the wall, then they're going to write on the wall. Mm-hmm. But if you draw the line at respect all private property, respect everything that belongs to everybody else, don't open this, don't touch that, don't have your hands on this. If you teach them like that, then they never write on the wall. Mm-hmm. They might have their hands on something you don't want them to, but they didn't write on the wall.
Right. Anyway, I think the point is, particularly with children, that you need to not teach them that they need to not do things. You need to teach them what they need to do.
Yeah.
And you need to give them good outlets and, you know, teach them early that...
Going back to the dog thing, one of the very proven methods with dog training is to keep the dog busy. If the dog is of a working breed, then they literally strap backpacks on the dog and run him around just carrying bottles of water. Mm-hmm. It gives him something to do, something he thinks he's involved in. And I think, especially with kids, you know, if you can get them involved in doing the normal things that you're doing day to day, then you can keep their minds more occupied. And this is something that I think schools and our current lifestyle of having, you know, two parents working and the kids are at school babysat all day, and then they come home and they're dumped in front of the TV. They're, instead of having a constant interaction with an adult, like you would have in a natural setting, they're shoved into a classroom with 30 other kids.
The exact same age.
Their peer level is teaching their behavior rather than having an example of a single or two or three adults that are right there interacting with them on a constant basis. They've got 30 other people that are their age. And so the worst aspects of behavior for that age level are intensified mm-hmm. rather than singling out those behaviors and saying, don't do that. That's right. Not how an adult behaves. And, oh, that's one other thing I wanted to touch on. If you teach your 2-year-old to behave like a 2-year-old, when they're 14, they're still going to be a 2-year-old.
Yep.
But if you expect your 2-year-old to act like an adult, now, don't demand that they act like adult, but lead them towards that. Mm-hmm. That's the goal. So if your goal is to have an adult, then you start teaching them to be an adult as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. And so what does that mean? Don't baby talk to kids if you want them to talk clear.
Right.
Don't expect them to act like a 6-year-old if they're a 6-year-old. Yep. Expect them to act like a 7 or an 8 or a 9-year-old. Constantly set the bar up higher for them.
Yeah, I see a lot of these people who, you know, I was at the doctor's office the other day and I was reading through the parenting magazine and they were like, you know, and all of these tips, and one of them was, don't forget, your 11 or 12-year-old can make their own snacks. And I'm like, are there 11 and 12-year-olds that aren't making their own snacks? Really?
You were baking your own pizza at 12.
Like, your kid ought to be able to know how to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich by about the time they're 5. And if they don't, you need to stop making them peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
What grade would a 12-year-old be?
That would be like 6th grade.
Okay. So you could, when you were like the equivalent of about 1st grade, you could pound out dough, put sauce on it, put cheese on it, put the toppings you wanted. You couldn't reach the oven.
That was a height issue.
That was an industrial oven in a restaurant, by the way. Our kids in that age bracket were in the back of a restaurant. We were homeschooling, and we were living like gypsies, spending more time in a van than in a house. We at one point...
Vans aren't houses? Wait.
Vans are mobile houses. Well, caravan. Well, I think we've about hit our time frame. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
Oh, no. I think that's a topic that we can continue to discuss further. But
Yeah, we didn't really cover it. I got off on a rant there, but we could really put some time on that, and we should come back and revisit it, just like we revisited the voting thing. And we'll talk about voting again. I need to go over and read Roderick Long's article and read Tom Wood's other two articles on that. And because, like I said, I don't know everything, and my position is constantly evolving. And anybody who has a static position is kind of like that crazy guy who predicted the rapture the other day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, I don't actually think he's crazy. I don't really think he's crazy. I think he's dishonest, and he's a horrible human being that takes advantages of the naiveness of other people. That's what I think about that man.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. That's
neither here nor there.
That wasn't supposed to be the topic, and we had specifically said we weren't going to talk about him, and then I go and violate the rules. That's what happens when you start giving an anarchist a bunch of rules. Okay. Well, thanks for listening to us. Be sure and stop by badquaker.com. We'd sure love to hear any feedback. You know, you can just log on there and say anything you want to say. You can hate us or love us or whatever.
And if you want to give us emails suggesting topics, that'd be great, too. We can dance around the email and not give you a straight answer.
Yeah, just like we did this one. And the last one. Didn't we do an email last week, too, that we danced around and didn't answer? If you want to email us at badquaker@badquaker.com. Kai's email is kai@badquaker.com, and I'm ben@badquaker.com. But if you email straight to the badquaker@badquaker.com, then the admin gets it, and it goes to wherever it's supposed to. So really, either three of those, if you have a question directed at one person, or at the podcast, or at the website in general, there you go. We are on iTunes, if you're not listening to us there. And maybe tell a friend about us.
We'll have a Facebook page up here pretty soon. We're working on it, so you can share that.
But, yeah.
Get the word out there. Share us.
And thank you very much for listening. I'm Ben.
And I'm Kai.
We're badquaker.com.